And our final case of this morning is CIT Communications Finance versus Maxwell, case number 083600.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Bruce Mankus. I'm here on behalf of CIT Communications Finance Corporation. I'd like to address the statute of limitations issue first.
That's a good idea. That's the principal problem in the case.
It was the grounds of decision by both of the courts below. The rule is, and I don't think it's been challenged by anybody in this case, that you can't be dismissed on a Rule 12b-6 motion based on statute of limitations unless you affirmatively plead yourself out of court, unless the party admits all the elements of an airtight defense. In this case, there are three allegations in the complaint which are the subject of the controversy. The first is that the trustee, on November 2nd, 2001, filed a statement of affairs in which he arguably stated that he didn't have any property of third parties. What he really said was property of third parties held, there was a box underneath, and there was an N/A in the box. The plaintiffs have specifically stated that they didn't believe the statement was true. They believed the trustee continued to hold the property at that time. Another event which occurred is that despite requesting the property back immediately after the bankruptcy started, the property was not returned. And several months went by. In fact, an entire year went by before the statutory period began when the property was not returned. Third, an auctioneer was hired to dispose of some of the assets of the estate. Defendants take the position that these three events put CIT on notice that something was wrong with the return of their equipment and their statute began to run at that time. Several problems with this construct. The first one is that's not necessarily, and we contend it's not, the event that was the gravamen of the complaint. The gravamen of the complaint was the loss of the property. The loss of the property did not occur on the date that the trustee said in the statement of affairs that he did not have the property. Did not occur on the date when he failed to file an inventory, another issue which was allegedly supposed to put CIT on notice. And did not occur on the day the equipment was not given back. In fact, it's quite possible, based on the face of the complaint, that the equipment was still in the trustee's possession at the beginning of the statutory period. So the CIT's first contention is, based on the face of the complaint, the wrongdoing alleged could have occurred within the statutory period, and there's no reason to think that it didn't. There's no inference which has been identified by the defendants which would suggest that.
I don't understand your argument, because I thought that your complaint was complaining about a failure to safeguard the property and a failure to return the property, and that in November of 2001, the trustee affirmatively said he didn't have the property. And so if at that time he said, I don't have it anymore, by definition he didn't safeguard it and he didn't return it to you, and wouldn't that be enough to put you on notice that we better start hunting this down?
Well, the complaint, Your Honor, says that the trustee said it on that date, but that it was incorrect, that the trustee still had it on that date. And the complaint also alleges that after that date, well, it doesn't say after that date. It says also alleges that CIT made phone calls to the trustee who said that the property was in possession of third parties and that by consulting those third parties, CIT would be able to get the equipment back. So, yes, the trustee did say they had the property, but CIT specifically said that the trustee was incorrect. So while the trustee might have been guilty of something at that point, the gravamen of the complaint isn't that the trustee misled CIT by stating that he didn't have property anymore. The gravamen of the complaint is that the property was lost.
Well, even if you allege that your client thought the trustee was wrong or in error, it's certainly enough to put your client on inquiry notice, and that's all that's required under Illinois law.
2 points on that, Your Honor. First of all, the inquiry notice becomes important only if the complaint would otherwise not be within the statute of limitations. We contend that it was within the statute of limitations because the loss of the equipment may have occurred within the statute of limitations. So There are plenty of Illinois cases stating that inquiry notice comes at a certain point. At a certain point, the plaintiff has amassed enough facts to know that they have to begin an inquiry into whether or not they've been wronged and whether or not the wrong was whether or not they've incurred a loss and whether or not the loss was wrongfully caused. But we contend that isn't relevant at the point we got to in the case. I see my time is up, so I'd like to reserve the rest of my time.
That's fine. Mr. Stanton.
May it please the Court, Don Sampin on behalf of Mr. Maxwell, the appellee. The relevant facts here, including those in the complaint and those of record, clearly establish that CIT was put on inquiry notice of its alleged wrong well before the key date here of May 7, 2002. And the relevant facts are that in June of 2001, the leases were rejected. The equipment was never returned to CIT, either before or after its demand for that equipment in July of 2001. CIT filed an administrative claim for rents in October of 2001, thereby recognizing its continuing injury. And then in November of 2001, as Judge Simon has already pointed out, Mr. Maxwell filed a statement of financial affairs in which he effectively disclaimed possession of CIT's equipment. Now, it may well be that CIT thought that statement was false. Maybe it didn't think that statement was false. It doesn't matter at this point because as of November of 2001, CIT had no equipment, it had no leases, it had no rents, and it had the trustee telling it that he had no possession. And those are the facts that establish inquiry notice as of that date, or in the words of the Draper case, which we've cited in the brief, with those facts in hand, CIT, as a reasonable person, was in the position that it would have inquired into the possibility, or should have inquired into the possibility, that Mr. Maxwell had engaged in some sort of actionable conduct. And that's what starts the ticking of the statute of limitations here. The complaint simply cannot withstand a statute of limitations analysis in the absence of saying something further. And that's been the law of this circuit ever since the Kincheloe case back in 1954. And it's Kincheloe has been reaffirmed many times, including through the Haynes case, which was decided just last year by the district court. The same rule applies under 9F of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. Rule 9F says that time is a material allegation with respect to testing the sufficiency of a complaint. And that's exactly what we're doing here with our motion to dismiss. We're testing the sufficiency of the complaint. And by failing to allege in its complaint the time-related information, such as that actionable conduct occurred after May of 2002, CIT has omitted a material allegation from its complaint, and the complaint deserves to be dismissed. And particularly is that the case under the circumstances here, where CIT at all times relevant had the power of discovery at its disposal. And that's important because under the Illinois discovery rule, the time starts ticking when the prospective plaintiff either knew or should have known of its causes of action. And that time period gets moved up considerably when the plaintiff has the power to take discovery and to issue subpoenas. And CIT's reply argument that, gee, it just didn't want to disrupt the administrative claims process by engaging in discovery is complete nonsense because CIT did, in fact, engage in discovery, not until 2006. But even at that point, had CIT promptly filed its complaint, it could well have been still within the statute of limitations period. But it waited another 5 or 6 months until May of 2007 to file its complaint and was well beyond the statutory period. Now, let me address just very briefly, if I could, the two main arguments that CIT seems to make here. One is based upon inferences, and the other is based upon reassurances. With respect to inferences, CIT argues that the lower court should have inferred that actionable conduct of some kind took place after May of 2002. There are many reasons why that argument has to be rejected. The first one is that they waived it. They never made the argument in the lower court. The closest they came was an argument they made not in the bankruptcy court, but in the district court, where they argued that, quote, the court should have assumed that the trustee may have breached fiduciary duties within the five-year statutory period. In support of that argument, they cite nothing from the complaint upon which such an assumption should have been based. And by arguing an assumption, they advocate a standard which no longer applies under the Bell Atlantic case, and I suggest the argument has been waived. Now, even if the court were to address the argument, all of the facts, all of the dates, all of the conduct alleged in this complaint take place in 2001, with one exception, and that has to do with the hiring of an auctioneer in January of 2002, still four or five months before the filing, the key date, the cutoff period of May 7, 2002. So for this court to assume or to infer that actionable conduct took place after May of 2002, the court would have to rely upon complete silence in the complaint, which, as I've already indicated, is inappropriate under the Kinchelow and Haynes lines of cases. Relying upon silence is also inconsistent with Bell Atlantic, and this court's decisions interpreting Bell Atlantic and Concentra and the other cases. CIT suggests at one point in its reply brief that, gee, the court should not overread Bell Atlantic, and certainly the court should not overread Bell Atlantic, but at least the court ought to read Bell Atlantic, as should have CIT. And had CIT read Bell Atlantic, it would have known that suspicions and speculation and negative implications are not sufficient to state a cause of action. What Bell Atlantic requires are plausible suggestions of actionable conduct. And when the only conduct alleged in the complaint has to do with events that occurred in 2001, this complaint simply doesn't meet the standard. There are, moreover, no allegations of continuing conduct by Mr. Maxwell in this complaint. But even if there were, the statute of limitations with respect to that continuing conduct would begin to tick at the outset of the continuing conduct and not at some later point in time. The continuing tort theory, for which CIT first cites authority in its reply brief in this case, in this court, applies only to certain kinds of torts. It does not apply to contract-based torts. It does not apply to contract-based causes of action. And in response to CIT's reply argument that there aren't any contracts involved in this case, let me just respond by saying that a cause of action for breach of fiduciary duty is itself a contract-based cause of action. And that's as indicated in the Illinois Supreme Court's decision in the Kinzer case that I cited to the court by a letter to the clerk's office just last week. The Kinzer case indicates that a cause of action for breach of fiduciary duty is one based upon contract, agency, which itself is a contract concept, and equity, and is not a tort. So the continuing tort theory simply doesn't apply here. Just say a brief word on CIT's other arguments, the reassurance argument. The theory here is that Mr. Maxwell made reassurances that CIT would get the return of its equipment. It's an argument based on whole cloth. The only paragraph in the complaint that they reference in support of the argument is one in which they allege that Mr. Maxwell, in response to CIT's requests for return of the equipment, told CIT, go talk to someone else. That is not an assurance of the return of the equipment. And absent any assurances or reassurances by Mr. Maxwell, that this whole concept of fraudulent concealment simply goes by the wayside. In order to have a fraudulent concealment, you have to allege fraud. They haven't alleged fraud, or at least any fraud, in accordance with Rule 9b. For those reasons, I'm going to ask the court to affirm For the alternative bases for affirmance, we'll just rely on the brief. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Minkus, how much time? You have 4 minutes.
I'd like to address a few of the issues which counsel raised. First, the issue of omitting the material allegations. Litigants have never been required to anticipate an affirmative defense and then plead facts which show that the affirmative defense doesn't work. And that is true before Bell Atlantic. Bell Atlantic does not say anything which changes that rule. The Concentra case decided by this court does not change that rule. No authority suggesting that litigants must now anticipate affirmative defenses and explain why those affirmative defenses aren't meritorious. In this particular case, there were indeed some allegations in the complaint which suggest that the trustee had acted improperly before the beginning of the statutory period. But again, they're not like the Haynes case. In the Haynes case, the plaintiff alleged that he was the victim of a battery and malicious prosecution, and he gave a specific date on which it happened, and it was before the start of the statutory period. In that case, he gave no explanation whatsoever as to why he didn't bring the case within the period. That's a case where the court thought, well, this case can't stand its Rule 12b-6 motion. Our case is much different than that. The allegations of the trustee's conduct that were alleged to have occurred before the statutory period were alleged to have been wrongful, but they were not the wrong. The wrong was the loss of the equipment. More importantly, an explanation was given. And counsel's not entirely correct when he says that the complaint alleges only that CIT was asked to contact third parties by the trustee. The complaint says was asked to contact third parties who could facilitate return of the equipment. That puts it in a wholly different category. If CIT was on inquiry notice, in other words, if CIT is required to rely upon a discovery rule because the court concludes that no events occurred, could have occurred within the statutory period, they did conduct an inquiry. It's alleged in the complaint. They called the trustee and asked him questions about how they could get their equipment back. And they received answers which they found to be satisfying. They were not required to assume that the trustee was making up a story and that he really had no idea where the equipment was or how it could be recovered. They were certainly not required to assume that the trustee may have already disposed of the equipment. Counsel also argues that the CIT could have used a Rule 2004 examination, a deposition under the bankruptcy court rules, to determine more about this. First, 2004 examinations are not given as of right. You have to show a reason why you're entitled to one. Admittedly, CIT did not request one. But had they requested one, there's no reason to think that Mr. Maxwell would not have given the same answers during his 2004 examination that he gave when they called him on the telephone and asked him where the equipment was and how they could get it back. To say that CIT should have availed itself of that 2004 examination assumes he would have told a different story under oath, and there's no reason to make that assumption.
When did the right of return of the equipment accrue?
I don't believe there is a deadline by which the trustee must return equipment.
I'm not talking about a deadline by which he must. I'm talking about when did your client's right to have the equipment returned accrue?
I don't know the answer to that, Your Honor, because I don't know the right to have it return accrue.
This was leased equipment. The
Yes.
estate had disavowed any intention to maintain possession, right?
Yes.
When did that decision get made as of record?
When did they conclude that the equipment was lost, Your Honor?
No. When did your client's right to have the property returned accrue?
I believe they had the right to have the property returned immediately upon the filing of the bankruptcy, Your Honor. But I suggest that the more important question is, when did their right to bring this lawsuit accrue? When did their cause of action accrue? And their cause of action would have accrued on the date the equipment was lost. Thank you.
All right. Our thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement, and that concludes the calendar today. The court is in recess until 9:30 tomorrow morning.